Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to another episode of the Self-Build Plus podcast, where we chat with self-builders, suppliers, and experts about all things home building and renovating in Ireland on both sides of the border. I'm Astrid Mattsson, your host and the editor of Self-Build magazine. Joining us today is Roger O'Connor from County Cork. He appeared in the summer 2020 edition of Self-Build magazine. And his house also made the cover of our systems guide in the summer 2021 edition. And that's available from all good news agents and on selfbuild.ie under the advice tab. So, Roger, if you want to get us started and tell us a little bit about your project in Cork and how it came about and the site is in particular, I suppose you need somewhere to build, don't you?
Yeah, well, it's always handy to have a place to build before you, you know, before you try and go do it. But yeah, so first of all, thanks for having me on. It's great. We've obviously had a few chats over the course of the months and over the course of lockdown. So it's nice to be able to do this kind of thing. But yeah, I suppose that's the one thing that we were very lucky that we managed to get the build done before the new world changed, you know, so I was very fortunate in that regards. But in terms of, I guess, our overall journey, you know, we married back in 2012, and we bought our first house in 2013, just on the north side of Cork. We have family on the south side of Cork, so no, not a horrendous distance, but I guess it was our first time living up the north side of Cork, and it was a 1970s detached house, which luckily was structurally perfect, but it was very much outdated in terms of its decor, you know. So we kind of at the time had no kids, and we were happy out to you know, do the refurb and stuff in the evenings and the weekends, and do all the tile shopping and all that good stuff that you do. And, you know, it took 3 or 4 years to get it to a point where we were like, oh, yeah, this is now, you know, modern and nice. And we were very happy with it. And then, you know, obviously two kids came along and we were kind of going, oh, this is feeling a little bit cramped. And at that point, we kind of said, all right, well, look, the answer is an extension. And quite frankly, that's where the conversation started. So we had a house in North Cork, and we were saying, okay, well, look, let's go for an extension. And I'm an engineer, so I kind of did up some rough drawings, very rough. I'm not an architect, I'm an engineer, and kind of got a rough price. I mean, very rough price on what it would take to do it.
From where? From a builder?
Well, from the, whatchamacallit, the Quantity Surveyors website. They've got a very good approximation site there,
which is the rebuilding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's mainly used for insurance purposes, but it is very handy when you're just going to spitball roughly where things are going to land, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it was for a fairly you know, normal extension. It wasn't going to be anything mad. I can't remember, it was like 50, 60K or something, you know, it was like, okay, that's a number. And then one Sunday morning, just having coffee with my in-laws, and they kind of just asked the question, what if you sold the house and put that kind of money with it? What could you get then? Do you know, my father-in-law loves doing that, loves just kind of throwing out these like random left of field questions. And we kind of went, oh, that's an interesting way of looking at it, I suppose. And up to that point, I guess I was always into housing design, I suppose, and certainly passive housing and that type of thing. And my wife was very much into internal design, and we'd gone through that journey with our first house, so we knew we both liked it. And it was just trying to figure out, okay, well, what is it that we might do next? I suppose, you know, either stay and build an extension, buy someplace else, or possibly build someplace else. And then kind of we went down to Daft and stuff, and we looked at what options were there. We're like, okay, well, look, it's feasible to, you know, kind of shelve the extension idea and just go buy, put extra with, and then, you know, buy a pretty nice place somewhere. And then during another Sunday morning conversation, my in-laws just reminded us that if they wanted, there's a site beside them that we could use, which was
handy.
To be fair, well, it was amazing. To be fair, like, it's one of these things that they had foresight to think of these things 30, 40 years ago, you know, and like, we were very, very lucky in that regards. And that for us, honestly, was a game changer. Because that kind of meant that, okay, well, now we can realistically look at moving back down to nearer family. Even though, like, it was only North Cork and, you know, they were South Cork, it's not horrendous, but every weekend when you're driving through the city just to get to the other side of the city, you know, it's 45 minutes each way gone out of your weekend.
That's mad.
Yeah, all you're trying to do is meet your family, you know. So, so it was kind of going, okay, hang on, we're spending a lot of time on the south side and not much time on the north side, and you know what's the real benefit here for us? And saying, well, it's being nearer family, it's being nearer the things that we like to do down here, you know, going to beaches, that kind of thing. So we said, okay, is this a runner now? You know, like, can we actually go and build something? So then that conversation got very, I suppose, serious in terms of trying to think about what it is we would like to do and could do. And then I guess we just decided, okay, let's go do that. Let's actually, you know, chase this down properly. And I suppose my experience of the building industry, where I was a civil structure engineer for a number of years, doing housing estates and one-off builds and that type of thing. So I knew the lay of the land. I'd also been heavily involved with energy and all that side. So that was my passion side was energy and renewables. So I was kind of jumping up and down about the engineering side, going, can we do this? Is this something we can do? You know, like, here's all these books about passive housing. And my wife was going, that's wonderful. Stop showing me windows. Here's all books about finishes and couches and colors and, you know, nice places. So we were kind of, okay, we could do this. But I guess because of my experience of building, I knew the pitfalls. You know, I knew kind of where the trouble would lie. So I kind of said, look, happy to do this, and I think we should absolutely do this, but let's do it kind of as a self build, but not necessarily a direct labor self build. Like, my heart goes out to those people who literally, you know, do everything, you know, they do the drawings, they do the block laying, they do the plastering, they do the painting, you know, they, my God, fair play to them. But from our experiences of the previous house, we knew what that looked like, you know, we knew what that takes from you, and what it gives you in the end, like, it's very rewarding. But we were looking at this game now with a bit of experience and two kids in tow.
Young kids as well, I presume.
Yeah. Very, very young kids, 1 and 3. So it was like, yeah, that's, you know, realistically speaking, I'm not the biggest guy in the world, so I'm not going to go and laying block of a weekend at any kind of pace that would make it worthwhile to build a house. So
Yeah, and you need skills to do it properly as well, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, look, I suppose my kind of take on that is the self-build thing is brilliant. And, you know, obviously I'm in the self-build community as well on Facebook and stuff and about yourselves as well. So it's great to have the support there. And that's one thing that we've certainly found is that community are very, very helpful when you need help with answers. It's great to have that. But on the same front, there's some things that, you know, if you spend 3 hours doing, it might take a qualified carpenter an hour to do. And mm-hmm. if you're very good at, like, say, programming or something, and you spent those 3 hours programming, you're probably better off spending those 3 hours programming and paying, you know, an expert for their time to do it in an hour. So I suppose that's kind of where I come down on those things. So our approach to the self-build, and if you can imagine, I'm using air quotes around self-build, was to be a very informed client. So we hired an architect. He's an excellent architect, actually, locally in Ovens area here in Cork. And he helped us walk through that early process of trying to get from what was in our brains to something on a page that we agreed with each other on. Because, you know, there was two of us in us. You know, there's me and my wife, and we each come at this from a slightly different angle, where I'm coming at it from a very kind of passive, but also a very engineering, which basically normally means box. And my wife's coming at it from a very kind of artistic side and light and color, you know, which generally doesn't include a lot of engineering components. So he was very, very good at being able to, I suppose, stitch together what it is we wanted. But one of the things that we had to start with, and anybody who's going on this kind of journey, I'd recommend that they literally, yourself and whomever it is you're doing it with, or you're on your own or whatever, is you sit down and just blank page of paper and say, what is it I want this place to do for me? Not just now in whatever your current circumstance is, but, you know, in future times, if you want it to be that kind of forever home. You know, maybe you don't. Maybe you want it to be just a home for the next 4 years when you're free and single or whatever, you know. But having a really serious think about what it is you wanted to do, like even down to, you know, the fourth bedroom, right? This famous fourth bedroom that, you know, what's it going to be? It's like, well, if it's a fourth bedroom, it'll be empty most of the time. So I hate waste, right? I'm nowadays I'm involved in process engineering and stuff, so waste just annoys me nonstop. So,
and it costs money.
It does. Like every block you lay, every square meter that you build, you know, you're paying whatever the rate is now. I forget. Is it like 2,000 euros a square meter, or whatever the build cost is? Like, I've thankfully forgotten all those numbers. They've gone completely out of my head. But like every square meter you add on is an extra cost to your build. You know, so like I suppose you don't. Like I have a bit of a passion for the micro homes as well. Now, I appreciate we did not build a micro home. But when you look at what people can do with space, it's amazing. Do you know? It really, really is. So I suppose it's just being mindful of that, of what it is that you wanted to do. Because at the end of the day, why are you doing this? You know, why are you doing your own build? It's because you want to create a space that works the way you want it to work for you and for yours, you know? Well, that was my reason anyway.
Yeah. So how did you find your architect?
I remember, bearing in mind, this is almost 3 years ago, so you're going to have to forgive me, but I remember going around to the different architecture houses in Cork and just trying to feel them out for what it is that they could do for me and how they could help me out. And I had one or two contacts as well from when I was an engineer doing that stuff. And one difficulty I found actually on that was they wanted you to come in and have, you know, a paid consultancy just for trying to feel them out to see if they could work with you. And you know, I was like, hang on, a relationship in this is very important. You have to have a good relationship with your architect. You know, you have to vibe each other really. A bit of healthy pushback is very good because that pushes both of you to be better. But like you need a good relationship. So I suppose I worked on that one very much on vibe. You know, it's an artistic piece. So like, you know, do ye get on well? You know, do you have a similar-ish kind of vision for what a house can or could be? So I started going through the Self-Build magazine actually as well and looking for anyone with a Cork build. And then looking to see who they used, and then kind of went down through that. So I built up kind of a short list of 3 or 4 architects that I kind of thought might be able to do something for me in the space. And through kind of talking to them and stuff, I ended up coming down to Madhouse Architecture with Tom.
And did he charge you for that initial consult?
No. He did. He's going to kill me now because he might charge me over. But no, he didn't, because like it was just practical. You know, it was just like, let's just meet up, let's just have a chat together, see if we vibe, and see if we want to work with each other. You know, and it was great. Like those first few initial conversations with Tom, really went from being like a blank page. Where we had ideas and we had concepts and we had kind of, I guess what people would call now kind of a vision board or whatever, but just kind of going through Pinterest and picking out big images and small images. And by that, what I mean is, you know, pictures of whole buildings. So if you go to, like, for example, Self-Build Magazine, you'll see all these lovely buildings and you kind of go, oh, that, you know, I want that kind of sharpness, or I want it to mellow into the ground like this one over here, or whatever. But then also kind of the smaller pictures of, oh, you know, an architrave, or a doorstop or whatever, you know, and the really, really, really small detail. And kind of going to Tom with that and kind of saying, look, these are a kind of ideas, you know, and some of them are very left of field, some are very right of field. And then Tom came back to us in a very structured way, which is great. With 3 options, which reflected that, all with kind of a general theme through it, but kind of 3 ways it could go. And then there was, I suppose, the benefit of what I had, which is just the engineering component, because I knew I wanted it to head very high up on the BER rating. So like there was no question it was going to be an A, if not more, right? And by more, I mean if not passive. I said, look, Tom, I need for me, for what I believe in, I need to drive it that way. And Tom was already very well versed, to be fair, in the whole passive side. I guess I just brought things on a touch more with the engineering component of it. But again, he was very, very open to all that. Like, and he had some fantastic ideas as to how to bring it on. So then he did up kind of, I guess, the rough, you know, rough to a point where we were able to then go and talk to the planners about it. So we'd had an initial.
So what, wait, just to bring you back, what were the 3 options when you're saying there were kind of 3 broad designs he came back with?
So it was largely around, so the general theme that he was, quite frankly, you know, trying to convince us of, because, you know, architects have their own vision of what should be as well, you know. So it's kind of this sculptor looks at a piece of clay and just, you know, is trying to figure out what the clay is underneath all that excess clay. So same thing with Tom, that he was trying to say, listen, this is my vision for what this space can be, and he was just trying to convey that to us. So in his 3 versions, I remember there's one version that had like, so our house is effectively sections of 3. So we have a more easterly section, and then there's a taller middle section, and there's a smaller western section. So the eastern section, he had in as a barrel roof. So I'm sure you've seen a lot of the very beautiful designs. If you watch, you know, even the Home of the Year awards, there's people around who have these beautiful barrel roofs on a portion or all of their houses. And I guess that's often very reminiscent of a kind of an agricultural setting, which we're kind of in. So we're outside Ballincollig, but we're out in the countryside, but we're in a group of housing. So we're in an area where, you know, it's not green fields as far as the eye can see. It is a cluster of houses together. So it's not quite a country farmhouse look. So we kind of looked at the barrel roof and we're like, yeah, it's not quite for here. And the other 2 options then, I can't remember the 3rd one, but the 2nd one is pretty much what we went for. It was pitch roofing throughout, but with these really, I suppose, dramatic, I guess you might call it, window splits. So a lot of our windows go from floor to ceiling height, but they're actually reasonably narrow in some cases. On the north side, especially it being a passive house, that's the kind of normal setup you have. The general way is you have large glazing to the south and little glazing to the north. But trying to do that in an architecturally sensitive way is, I think, challenging without making it look, you know, like a bunker, for lack of a better description. So Tom had a great approach of these slitty windows on the north side of the building, which was replicated on the south side of the building with slitty windows interposed with larger windows as well, capturing that extra light from the south side. So it was, I guess, when you look at it initially, it is a bit unusual, you know, in terms of it's not normal kind of two up, two down, you know, one door, four windows kind of setup. But we looked and we went, yeah, okay, let's do it. It was a touch outside of our comfort zone, to be frank. But that's what Tom was doing. Tom was trying to stretch us, you know, to being a bit more than what you think you are yourself, you know, in terms of your design. So yeah, he was really, really, really good at that, in fairness. And that was the real benefit of having him in. So like we had our own I guess architectural ideas and things like that, but he was able to just bring that extra clarity to it, or you know, the kind of the his favorite line was, how about this? You know, and he'd come up with something mad, and then you're kind of going, okay, Tom, just relax a bit. But you know what? You're not entirely wrong. So yeah, it was actually good fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So what year was this then? This was what, 2019?
Oh, yeah, it was September 2017 is when we first engaged Tom. So that was when literally we first met him in my in-laws' house, because we decided that it was worthwhile only ever having meetings with him here in terms of on-site. Because my view on it is you're building the house to take advantage of the location. There's no point in talking about the location if you're not in it. Do you know? So I suppose we spent a bit of time, first of all, just trying to figure out where the house would go on site. And for that, actually, one thing that really, really helped was we just had a very frank initial conversation with local planners who were brilliant. Like they're very, very accommodating, in fairness. They were great. And we went in and we said, look, we're looking at a building here. We had all our kind of reasoning prepared as to Louise's you know, connection to the area and all that, and I had redone kind of a significant dossier of information about that, and within 10 seconds the planner went, yeah, that's fine, don't worry about that, you know, you're clearly okay, don't worry about it. And I was like, oh, okay, I've just spent 2 weeks putting this together, but okay, it's fine. You know? But they were brilliant. Like,
you were prepared at least. You never
know. Yeah,
known.
Exactly. Yeah, but they were so helpful. But
was the pre-planning meeting.
Yeah, yeah, and like it was almost a pre-planning in terms of we didn't even have a design. Do you know? We just had kind of a thing of we're in the middle of designing a house, but you know we'd like to put it someplace on this site. Honestly, we have no particular preference as to where we go. We're thinking maybe A or maybe B, but you know, what do you think yourself? And the planner straight away went, don't do A, do B, that'll work. Anything else? It was like, yeah, okay.
Listen,
so we came home.
If it was always like that, be brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think to be fair, we went in very open, you know, like very much kind of, you know, we want to work with you. You know, what do we have to do to work with you? And there was an initial kind of after the meeting kind of went, oh, because A is not an option as far as they're concerned, it's only B. And then there was a second of, do we push for A? And then I was like, no, you know, we don't need to push for A. We have B. B is a good option. So let's just go with B. And, you know, let's kind of, I suppose, as you might say, lean in. You know, let's just lean into it. Let's just go with it. And that'll be a great place to build anyway. So let's go there. So then once we had the location in terms of the exact location on the site, we were then able to bring the conversation on further with Tom and say, okay, well, this is where it's going to be. Let's talk about orientation. Let's talk about what you'll see through what window, what shape and size that window then should be. So like you start to get into a very, I suppose, the more artistic mode of it, of saying, okay, well, if you imagine that we're sitting here looking out that window, what is it you'll see? oh, I'll see a septic tank. Okay, maybe that's not the best thing to be seeing. And like in our area, it's kind of a flat land, which is to the north side has a very dramatic hill on it, which is all lovely old trees and greenery. So that's lovely to be able to look on. It's on the north side though. So on my engineering head, I'm going, but I need small windows on my north side. You know, I can't be having big windows looking out into this hilly green side. So we were able to overcome all that through Tom's tall, slitty windows. So we were able to get the drama of the hill without the expense of having big windows to that side. Do you know? So it was just trying to piece all those things together, saying, okay, well, now we know what we want the house to do for us. Now we know where it's going to sit. And now we know it's, you know, what it's going to be looking at. We can figure out how it needs to come together. Do you know? And then, yeah, we started to get near the build. So that was like September 17. And then said, right, okay, you know, at this point we need to start moving into the actual construction. Because I had put on at the restriction of wanting to head to passive, I needed about 6 weeks just to sit with the design as we had kind of envisaged it at that point. To say, okay, would this work as a passive design, or is it too much of a lift between the design and where it needs to be? Because one experience I've had before, or I suppose in my experience of this before, trying to shoehorn, you know, a passive performance or an A rated performance or whatever into a building that's already architecturally designed without any of those features in mind, is an extremely difficult uplift, do you know? And the minute you're anywhere near planning, you might as well just forget it, because that's the plan, do you know? You go to planning with what your plan is.
Yeah.
And trying to change it afterwards, there's no point. Or very little point. Or you end up, you know, going stir-raving crazy as you're trying to change the planners, or you're trying to change plans, or you're trying to shoehorn things in. It's just very, very difficult. So the route I wanted to take was, we had, you know, a very strong outline plan from the architect. And then I sat with it for 6 weeks, and I ran it through what's called a passive house planning pack, which is basically just a very fancy Excel sheet. That's all it really is. And because of my previous experience around BERs and stuff, I was reasonably happy with it in terms of I was reasonably comfortable with it. So I was able to model that myself and get an understanding for how the building as it was conceived would behave, and would it actually be feasible to get it to a passive building, which... My initial concept of that in my own head was that it would never need heating, that the sun would always shine, and that we would live energy free, so off grid was the objective. And then by the modeling one night, I kind of realized, oh, hang on, while in the overall annual terms, yes, we will be energy neutral, which is to say that the sun will generate as much energy for the house as it needs over the course of the year. We'll come a period in like November, December, when we really won't. That, you know, there's just simply not enough sun happening. And there's not enough internal heat generation happening to meet the heat demands of the house in November and December. So I said, right, okay, well, I need a stove. Because I was still very much sticking to my off-grid principles. So at this point now, I was moving slowly towards having a stove and having a generator for my electricity, right? And then I said, great, that's what I'll do. I have a stove in the house in North Cork. I'm familiar with them. I'll just do that. And then I just sat down the next night and I went, I wonder how many times a day I'd be restoking that stove. So I did the calculation and oh, jeekers, I'm restoking this every 3 hours for, you know, 4 weeks flat. I said, okay, this is clearly not going to be a realistic solution to this problem. So then I stepped down to the next bit of, okay, in terms of passive house, you start by saying I never need heat. And then you step down to saying, okay, I'll sometimes need heat. So then in the sometimes I need heat conversation, it's all about, okay, where does that heat come from? What's the best source for that? And for that, I ran through literally all the options. We don't have grid mains connected gas here. So I looked at the LPG option for an LPG with a boiler, and then also looked at LPG with a heat pump, because you can actually get them now. It's gas-fired heat pumps, so you can get them. And then at the time, still very much sticking to the idea of passive and renewable and sustainable, bio-LPG was only just newly on the market, which is biogas. It's a renewable form of gas that's available on the market. That was only just on the market in Ireland at that time. And they weren't selling it into residential. They were only selling it to commercial. So I was like, okay, I don't know if I can get that. And, you know, I'd have to just get normal LPG, which is fine. Like, there's no difference between the two, you know, in terms of its properties or anything. And it works perfectly fine. But from an ethical, I guess, perspective, it was like, it's just not quite marrying with my expectations. So then in the end, came down to, okay, well, do you know what? Air source heat pump is probably the best way to go. And then running that through the passive house planning pack, yeah, that was working well. And then marrying that together with a PV system, you start to build up a fairly robust design for a passive house. So that's kind of where we landed in the end. And to be honest, during all this, when I was making all these mad changes, you know, during the course of the 6 weeks, I was trying to figure out what the insulation needed to be and what the window spec needed to be, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Louise was kind of just looking at me going, "What are you finished with that yet?" It's like, come on, get off it. You know, get going about the other stuff. It's just
cost factor though, you know, it seems like a lot. Did you go for underfloor heating then for the that's a lot of expense, isn't it? If you only need heat for 2 months, it seems like a bit overkill, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I think in the end, that's where the modeling world meets reality. Quite frankly, I'm quite glad that we didn't just go for a boiler a stove, you know, that would only give out heat in a kind of general area for 2 months of the year, because we've proven to find that actually that's not true. You kind of do really need some form of heat going into the building over the course of about 6 months. Yeah, you do think that it is quite wasteful, but when you realize that what the heat pump does for you is give you your hot water, which you need all year round, then you kind of start to understand, okay, well, actually, because of the way heat pumps operate, they're extremely efficient. You know, they're north of 300% efficient. That's pure because they're not trying to generate the energy. They're only moving it from one place to another. So they're very, very good from that perspective, provided that you can, you know, I guess, address the electricity piece of it. And that's where the PV side comes in. So the idea that I recognized I needed to have hot water anyway. So I need a hot water cylinder or else you have instant hot water everywhere, which, you know, okay, is an option, maybe. But we just went the other way, given that we said, look, we need heat anyway. So heat pump will do it. Heat pump will do hot water for us. It'll also do, obviously, heating. During the summer, absolutely not. It's actually the inverse problem. It's overheating is a problem there, which I also modeled for, by the way. So went through it fairly in depth. But for a start, you cannot have it at all in the first place, which basically just means doing the design so that it doesn't happen.
Yeah, but that's what you tried to do.
Yes, but I had, I suppose, knowing that, I accepted my contingency plans, right? So don't have it overheating in the first place is the initial thing. But if you go, no, but I really want those big windows to the south, you know, and nothing you say is going to move me from those big windows. You go, okay, in that case, put in something that will help you to stop that from happening, such as curtains or a brise-soleil, which is like your overhang. To the external of a building, just to help stop that sunshine in the middle of summer, you know, so that 3 o'clock strong sunshine, that's where your problem is going to happen, because you've got a big thermal mass built up in the house. It's getting quite hot already, and then you got this really strong sunshine whatever it is, about 3 o'clock in the day. But the curtains will solve that, you know, so curtains can do it for you. A brise-soleil can do it for you. So there's design is the first step. A passive reaction is the second step. So a passive reaction being curtains or open a window or grease legs or something like that. Or even foliage, you know, having trees, designing, putting trees in a place, deciduous trees, in the winter will leave the light in because there's no leaves on them. But in the summertime, they'll give you shade because there's leaves on them. You know, it's great. They're versatile. They're wonderful. But they're the passive reactions. And then if you really need to, and honestly, it is the last course, but there's the active action. So the active action is, okay, you can argue opening a window, but it's down to your air conditioning, you know. So you have a mechanically ventilated heat recovery system in most of these kind of houses nowadays. So you can do a reasonably passive kind of summer bypass, which basically means that where your heat exchanger would normally take heat from your room and give it into your fresh air coming in, you just stop it doing that. You said, no, just give me the fresh air only, please don't exchange the heat. So what that does is that helps to dampen down the temperature in the house. So that's the first thing, that if you are specifying a house, and even if you don't go do the modeling that I did, right? But just get a summer bypass on the MVHR unit. They're not mad expensive. They're like an extra 200 quid or something like that. It will help just to kind of avoid some of those really peak heat times.
Yeah. And that's what you use, do you?
I specified it. It didn't go in. And yeah, I missed it. So it didn't go in. Honestly, there was just a mix up on things. And at that point in time, like that went in at the same time as the painting was being done, at the same time as everything was being done. So there was a lot of things on at the one time, and I missed it. And then after the fact, I went, oh, lads, where's the summer bypass? And everyone just looked at each other and went, not in. We're like, okay, well, first of all, I want a credit for that because it didn't go in and it's in the contract, so therefore give me a credit. So we went, grand. And then I was left with the engineering problem of, okay, but I still have overheating. So what do I do about this? And I found a very simple solution is just turn it off. So you turn off the MVHR during daytime in the summer and it works just fine. It does the job.
Right. You know?
Open. Okay. We only have four windows that open in the house. So open some of the windows, open some of the doors, and you're grand. It works just fine. We still have the curtains option. I suppose just to be clear, we didn't put curtains up. So some people could say, we should not just do the curtains route first.
Heat's in, I don't know.
The curtains will stop the heat.
Something external.
The curtains will stop the heat from coming in. The really last stand, if you really want to go down to it, and I haven't done it because I don't feel we need to, is you can actually get your heat pump to work in reverse. So you can get your heat pump to work as a cooling device rather than a heating device. Takes a small bit of extra, whatever, pipe work, etc. But yeah, we didn't quite go there yet. What I said I wanted to do was live in the building for us for a while. You know, we can retrofit all these things if we need to.
Yeah,
exactly. And to be honest with you, we've been in here now 2 years. We're at the start now of our second summer here. And there are periods of time when you need to learn how to, quite frankly, manage the building. You know, you need to learn, okay, well, open that window, open that door, and open that door, then we're good. But in terms of like the hassle of it, it's tiny. It's nothing. You know, it's lovely to have a bright, warm building that you can walk around in wintertime, you know, in shorts. You know, it's really worth it. Yeah, it's really worth it.
And the size of the house, sorry.
It's 220 square meters.
Yeah.
So like, look, to be fair, not small, not enormous. It's a very good size for us. I suppose, look, two adults, two kids, and then occasionally during non-COVID times, the odd guest. You know, the grandparents might stay over. My parents, obviously not. not the grandparents who live behind us. That would be weird. but yeah, so it's good size for how, I suppose, kind of our family will grow into. You know. Because two small girls have come to big girls soon.
Yeah, geez. I know. It goes fast, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So the insulation airtightness then, a modeling that you were doing that would have tied in with the building method as well, I presume. What was that in your Excel sheet?
That's where things, I suppose, again, experience from my side of engineering just helped, where it recognizing it was going to be a, you know, slightly more than standard complexity of build, really informed how we went about doing it. So a concern I had was if we went, you know, direct build, then, or direct labor, should I say, then I'm the one left trying to piece the carpenter together with, you know, the block layer with whoever put the insulation in to make sure they actually gave a damn that it went in right. And everything else, you know, the all the thermal bridging details, everything. So because of that, it was decided to go through a local main contractor instead, and say, look, let's, through our engineer. So even though I am an engineer, we actually hired an engineer as well. Willie, I used to work with Willie previously, and then he went out on his own and set up his own gig. I think it was BRH Engineering. And then I hired them for the build because I knew Willie. I knew that he was very much kind of the same as I am in terms of detail orientated and focused from an engineering perspective, so I could trust his work. And then that allowed me to fill the position of informed client, which for any engineer or any builder is probably an awful thing to have for someone who has a pretty good feeling for what it is they're talking about. So then Willie was able to steer us through putting together a tendering document. And because I had done the modeling and I had done the specifying, I had a fairly good idea as to what it is that I needed in the building or that I needed the building to be able to do. So by that, I mean, I didn't tell them how to achieve the airtightness we needed. I just told them that's the airtightness we needed. I can't even remember the number. I think it's 0.6 air changes per hour. It could be even 0.3. I can look that up. But it was an extremely tight in terms of air tightness. But by coming at it from the perspective of putting the requirement to achieve that on the builder rather than on the designer, because the designer can design anything they want, but the builder may not build it. But if you put something like the air tightness must be X onto the builder in the contract, then they have to meet it. And it's their responsibility to meet it.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Do you know?
What's the penalty for them not to?
No, that's very true. Contracts are only ever as strong as the penalty clause that they contain, right? That's simply the truth. But to be honest, that's where good reputation and good relationships come in. At the end of the day, you don't want to be going to the penalty clause in the contract, because if you're at that point in the contract, then you've managed to break down in every step before that, and there's lots of steps before you get to there. Do you know, at the very, very start, there's simply a straight up conversation saying, look, these things are very, very important to me. I need you to get them right. So it's making sure that you and, you know, and your builder are on the same page. Again, very similar to the architect, that you've had a bit of a meeting of minds. Like, okay, they don't have to be quite into passive housing as you are or whatever, but they have to at least appreciate what it is you're trying to do. They have to vibe with you on our level. You know, you don't have to be best buddies, but they have to be able to, it has to be a mutual appreciation or mutual respect. And to be fair, we tendered out. So our engineer, Willie, put together a very good tender pack.
Did that include the build method? Did you specify block work and
what kind of insulation? We specified the thermal U-value that the wall had to achieve.
Okay.
We identified a suggested spec that would be able to achieve that. So one thing I was conscious of, I didn't want to go specifying, you know, oh, you know, it must be a U-value of X, you know, knowing that that was completely unachievable. You know, that's not a place to start from. So you can set stretching targets, absolutely, but they have to be achievable. Otherwise, you know, it's you're on a hiding to nothing. So yeah, we gave them an indicative spec as to what would be able to achieve that U value we wanted them to achieve. And equally with the windows, you know, we said, look, it needs to be triple glazed. I think triple glazed, argon filled, e coating, all that good stuff. And then in some of those kind of things, we did kind of detail, you know, whether it was like Aluclad PVC or, you know, timber or whatever. So, you know, you need to give them a bit of a steering, because the more detail you can put in the spec, the more accurate the price will be in the end. You know, if you go to them saying, I want a house, jeekers, you know, the number is going to be whatever. You know? Whereas if you go to them really drilling it down, nailing it down, It just helps the communication. It really does. It also helps your own clarity, because you've thought about these questions before they come up on site. And trust me, there will be enough questions come up on site. Even if you thought about it to the nth degree, there'll still be questions come up on site. Do you know?
Yeah.
So we went out for tender on that. And like Murphy New Homes came back as just simply being like, they weren't, I don't think they were the cheapest on it. But like weighing up the options between, I suppose, cost and experience and ability, they won, you know? Because if in our minds, if you left it down to purely to cost, you're probably going to get what you pay for. And because it was, you know, a one-off, non-standard, slightly more complex build, you need to be able to trust that they can do it, you know? That they had done something similar before, that they're confident that they can and they're able to do it. And that's very important. You know, you have to be able to trust that they can actually do it. You have to have seen what they've done before as well. And our engineer had worked with them very well before. So we were happy that they could do one-offs. You know, they weren't doing housing estates and then started doing one-offs, or they weren't just tipping around doing extensions and then try to do a one-off. They had done this several places in our area. So they knew what they were doing.
So what did they come back with? What was the spec in the end? What did you agree to?
Oh my God, I'd have to send you on an Excel sheet. So like in basic terms, it is dry lining on the internal block wall. We have quinlite blocks on the internal face. Then it's a 150mm full fill rigid cavity insulation, which was a new one for them, to be fair. They took that on because I didn't want to pump the cavity. Pump the cavity doesn't get you as dense an insulation as rigid does. And the rigid we went for, being 150mm in the cavity, is a very, you know, in relation to older buildings, it's a very large cavity. And going for full fill, the risk obviously is always moisture ingress across the cavity. So you just need to be careful. So they were kind of, you know, they were looking at that kind of going, are you sure you want that? And I said, look, yes, that's what I want. So we agreed that that's what I wanted. And they put it in very well in first. And then it's just standard block and render external. So there was one or two interesting features that I kind of put on them. So our windowsills, a traditional windowsill is concrete. Ours is polyurethane foam with an external protection. It comes from what's it called again? Ecosills, I think they're called. It's from a crowd in Middleton and Cork. But to be honest with you, like, we don't have any windowsills on the ground floor because all of our windows go to the floor level. So we only have windowsills on the first floor. And I was happy that no one's going to be kicking a ball against them or, you know, stepping on them or anything at that level. if they are, we have a different problem entirely happening. So I wasn't concerned about durability or anything at that point, because I was happy that where they were going was out of reach. So Yeah, so it was that. The floor insulation, I think it's 250 mil of Kingspan insulation. Again, I'd have to go through the spec sheet entirely itself, but went with that. Gave them a fairly detailed book of thermal bridging details, which is basically how you treat the insulation at the edges of your floor and between floors. And we'd had a series of conversations around airtightness and how they were going to achieve it. And as was their treatment of the ceiling between the ground floor and the first floor and how they do that, because we went with Ducon slabs, Ducon concrete slabs. And they had a very, as was one thing that we really liked, or this was, I really liked anyway, about Murphy New Homes, was that in their offices, they had like a little mini section of a house, just showing some of the key details that they apply. And a lot of the things that I had researched and come up with, and quite frankly thought was a bit left of field, and I felt a bit embarrassed to be bringing it to people going, oh, I'd like you to do this. They had it in a little model house. So I was going, okay, these guys are already ahead of me on some areas. Now, other areas, I had kind of, you know, about the windowsills and stuff, I brought to them, but, you know, they were very confident they were able to do that kind of stuff. So that gave me confidence that they knew what they were doing. But yeah, so the spec was detailed, and, you know, we did read the contract. You know, we went through it with a fine-tooth comb. And quite frankly, you do. Like, it's the biggest expenditure of your life. You'll hopefully only ever do it once, maybe twice, in your whatever in your life. I know some people have done it three times. But, you know, it's a big, big deal. And, you know, you don't want to step into it lightly. And certainly,
so who drew up the contract?
So it came from Murphy New Homes as like the standard build contract, with some additional clauses just around the standard of performance to be achieved by the building, airtightness, that kind of thing, in the end. And then, yeah, so we went through it. So I again, I'd be fairly comfortable with contracts and that type of thing. So I went through it with Louise, and then I went through it with my engineer. And yeah, we just made one or two minor amendments just to clarify some things, and that was it. We were signed off on.
Yeah. So just to go back on the planning, how did that just go through quickly? Did you have to change anything, or
so
information requests or anything?
I suppose it really did help that I had spent, you know, a lot of years doing planning and planning applications and planning submissions and that type of thing. So I knew where the pitfalls were, I suppose, in terms of the engineering side. So, you know, anyone who's ever tried to do a self-build, you know, sight lines for road access into your entrance is always a topic, you know. You come to learn quite quickly about what the speed limit is on your road outside and what the sight lines are required for that. And then you know, might be tempted to get onto your local county councillor and see if you can get the speed limits reduced, you know, to try and help you with sight lines. So that kind of stuff just helped us to influence some decisions very early on. So like where we positioned our entrance, for example, I knew there was one side of the site was better to put the entrance than the other, just because I knew how the layout was in front and sightlines. So if I didn't know it, to be fair, the answer there would have been ring the engineer, get him onto site and ask him what's the best thing to do, rather than deciding I want my entrance here and I'm going to make it work come hell or high water. Do you know? So we were quite pliable in a lot of our decisions where we could go, look, we'll go A or B. You know, it was that thing again of we can put it here, we can put it there, whichever one you think would work best. On other things, I suppose we were quite stern. So one of my big things is I don't really like big front gardens because I don't really see the point of them. As far as I'm concerned, big front gardens are for the neighbors to look at. Why would you have them? I don't really see it. Back gardens are for the family. They're where your kids play. They're where you hang out. You know, you're not overlooked by anybody. It's where your privacy is. So for me, the positioning of the house was much nearer the road than some people would have said, oh, hang on, you know, you can go back further if you wanted to. But it was like, no, why would we? Back there is my private area. I want a larger private area. So that's kind of what we wanted to go for. So the planning then, like having having a proper then pre-planning meeting with the planners was great, because we went in with a design. You know, we had talked to them before we went in at all about the location, so they were okay with the location. We went in then with the design and we said, look, this is what we'd like to do. These are the colorings, you know, this is the shape. You know, because, you know, to be fair, what they're trying to do is they're trying to look at the proposal and see, does it fit in with, you know, the overall idea that they're trying to establish in the area? You know, does it fit in with the vision of what the local planning is? And that's all they're trying to do, to be fair. So had a great conversation with them, and honestly, they came back with very little in the way of commentary. So it did make life easier that I guess we were talking to them all the time, you know, constantly checking in with, not constantly, but, you know, regularly checking in, kind of going, we want to do this, you know, are we okay with this? And then we submitted the planning formally. And yeah, because we talked to them, because we had taken on any kind of questions they had, and we'd answered it in our submission. I think we got one request back for further information. I can't even remember what it was. It was nothing major. I have a feeling it might have been about the sight lines on the road, actually. Funnily enough, even though that was the one thing I spoke about. Then yeah, it was grand. And I suppose, like, there was some things we did very early on that, you know, when you're at the start of this journey, you think, oh my God, you know, oof, that's expenditure here. We're already spending money. We don't even have a block placed in the ground yet. You know, so you do like your site inspection. So, you know, we had our engineer and a digger on site for the day, digging holes around the place you know, looking to see what the conditions were like underground, because you can do all the amount of walking you like on a site, and you can poke as many sticks in the ground as you like and hum and haw and talk to the locals about, you know, has that ever flooded and all the rest. But until you break ground, until you get down a level, you won't know what's down there, do you know? So that's what we did. We did some trial holes around the place. I did obviously the P-test for the soakway and for the percolation area for the treatment plant, and just kind of got some of that homework done. Even things like hiring an architect, hiring an engineer. We had a guy in who just cleared some of the site for us as well, and just to help us get a better view of it before the diggers arrived on site, you know? So those things, you know, it is expenditure early on, but I'd say it's the best investment you can make, because it really helps to inform your decisions if you need to change things. Trying to change things later on in the middle of a build to try and overcome a problem, it's expensive.
Yeah. So then the next step in terms of your commencement notice, did you opt out? I presume.
Yeah, we opted out. But honestly, that was only because I'm, again, very comfortable with engineering and building and all that. So, like, I knew what I was looking at. Like, I had done civil structural, so I really knew what I was looking at. I had hired an engineer who I knew he knew what he was doing too. So, yeah.
And the health and safety aspect. So I suppose the architect.
Murphy New Homes. No, Murphy New Homes.
The contractor side.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Again, like, so it's like my background, being what it was, very, very focused on health and safety, and that element of things, to the point where we actually had a portion of the site cordoned off where we would go, and the other portion of the site was where the builders would go. And you know, because we had small kids who visited site every now and again, we'd kind of, you know, unless if the builders were here, we'd stay on our site, and when the builders weren't here, we would, you know, be able to walk around and stuff. But yeah, we went quite strict on health and safety, but yeah, you need to, as far as I'm concerned.
You have to. Yeah, it's a very dangerous place for sure.
Yeah, it is.
So this site, I presume they gave you a schedule of works and followed the schedule.
Well, I suppose that was maybe the one. So on the contract, they had a timeline. So in fairness, before we broke ground, it was 12 months. So we started discussions with Tom in September 17. We finally broke ground on site in September 18. And the contract, so the planning and the design and everything else had taken 12 months. You know, that's how long that site took. And then in the contract with Murphy Homes, with the builders, they had specified, 12-month build. And that was good. Very happy to have kind of a timeline in a contract. But I suppose from that side of things, a plan isn't a plan unless you have a program. So it's only a wish if there's no kind of plan around when things will happen and what's going to happen next and what order they all happen in. And to be fair, the advantage of going with someone experienced who has done this several times, like Murphy Holmes had, is that they know what they're doing. You know, they bring in their crews when they need to bring them in. There's very good handovers between crews, so they know what they're doing. But that was the one thing I did push for, was to see a program, because while they know what they're doing, I wouldn't necessarily know, do you know? In terms of, I didn't know down to the detail what they had planned next. So I asked them for a program, and to be fair, yeah, they gave me kind of a fairly good overview program that I was able to use to, you know, do a few things. First of all, stage payments. Obviously, you need to be able to kind of plan them out and track them out. From a finance perspective, you need to be able to see when you're going to be spending money.
That would have been outlined in the contract, wouldn't it? When you reach a certain stage, you would have paid the contract.
Yeah.
Which I presume would have coincided with your engineer's inspections.
Yes.
Yeah. So it would be just, so how many stages would that be? That would be just a handful, really, then.
I think it was six, if I remember correctly, including the snag list. So at the end, there was a period of time between, let's say, when the builders are finished on site, which is invariably, if you're doing a self-build, it's the day you move in, you know. About 6 months after that, then, you know, they close the snag list, basically. And then that's when you issue final payment. But to be fair, the stages are fair and reasonable, you know. Like, you need to make sure that you're paying for the work done. And not for any kind of future aspirational work, and certainly not for just materials on site. Like, never pay for materials on site, because they can go off site just as easy as they came on site. So having, I suppose, your engineer do the walk around and confirm that, yes, you know, the amount they're looking for is the amount of work done. Like, it's not only good for yourself, but you'll need it for the bank anyway. Do you know? So it's a requirement there anyway. But it is good to have that kind of checks and balances thing going on, where it's not just you looking at the builder and the builder going, oh, I need that money there now. You know, it's like, hang on a second here, what's going on? Do you know? And I suppose a big portion of this is, like, while, you know, I suppose rolling back to why we didn't go for a full, you know, direct labor self-build, even though we could have, like, and I you know, do have certain skills that would allow that, but the amount of work you do outside of all that anyway is a part of a full-time job. Do you know, just trying to keep track of is everything on schedule, you know, do they know what they're doing next, do they know, you know, has that decision been made, has the money been paid out, is the money in the account yet to pay them out, you know, there's enough going on in every other aspect apart from literally building the house, you know.
So in terms of the program, you're saying it was important to get your hands on the schedule. Was that as well to know how to, I suppose, time the kitchen? You probably got the kitchen separately, did you?
And yeah,
finishes and things.
Well, that's how exactly did, it how,
yeah,
well, it's two reasons really. One, to plan yourself, so that you know when you need to be making decisions. Do you know, because like the decisions that you make are really around how it's going to finish and how it's going to look in the end, you know. So, you know, what kind of flooring you're going to have, what color the tiles you're going to have, you know, how your kitchen will be, all these kind of things. And at the end of the day, they're the main decisions that you're going to be touching off of every day, you know. So they're the really, really important decisions, and they take time. Do you know, you need to be, you know, thinking about that far in advance. So having that program really lets you know, okay, you know, jeekers, I need to have a decision about the kitchen in a month's time or 2 months' time or whatever, because it takes 2 or 3 months to deliver a kitchen do. You know, it doesn't just happen overnight. And then the other bit of it as well is quite frankly, is to keep track on progress, so that you know, okay, hang on, lads, you said you'd have the floor poured by you know, whatever, October. It's now November. Okay, I appreciate, you know, it might only be a week of a difference between October and November, but are we on schedule? Are we late? You know, how are we running here? And it's about those two things together. I don't think you can rely on just the builder telling you, oh, it's all good, don't worry, it's all fine, it's all fine. You know, you need to have an understanding of what their plan is and where they're at in that plan.
And in terms of unexpected costs, did anything crop up that you hadn't foreseen?
Well, I suppose the detail that we've gone into for the spec day one. Actually, one other thing we did actually on the spec on the day one was I gave it to a QS to price up. So we had done our spec and we'd said, oh, this is what we would like in the build. And then I gave it to a private QS just to price up for me. To see.
This was before tendering, was it?
Yeah, exactly. Just to see, honestly, if we could afford what we wanted. Because there was no point in saying, oh, we want ABC, and then it comes in at, you know, 3 million euro, and you're like, oh, okay, maybe I'll only do A then. You know, you kind of need to have a feel for where you think you might land. And to be fair, he was great. Tenders came in fairly close to kind of what he had thought, within ballpark, you know, within reasonable ballpark. So kind of having that was useful. In terms of the unexpecteds, so yeah, we'd had a fairly detailed specification prepared. It was in the contract. It was priced under the contract. So it was, you know, it wasn't a vague price. They knew what they were looking at quantities wise and quality wise, etc. But even then, like I said, there's some things that just happen that you don't foresee. So even though we'd done our trial holes and we had dug around, and kind of one of the things with trial holes normally is that you don't do it directly in the place where you're doing the build. You do it slightly off because you don't want to affect where the foundations will ultimately be. So you do it off to the side. So that's what we did. And then when we went to actually dig the foundations, we found that there was a larger area, softer ground than we had thought, which meant you had to dig it out and pour more concrete in the foundation for it. So look, in terms of the grand scheme of things, was it horrendous? No, because, you know, look, you just had to do it, so you do it. But, you know, literally it was one of the first things on the build. We'd just broken ground a week prior, and now here we were. You know, oh, here's an extra.
Already over, like, budget.
Oh, yeah. Acres, yeah, you know. So,
but you mentioned the wastewater treatment you had to put in, but Irish Water, just getting a water connection wasn't too dear, was it? Or the ESB connection, you know, you didn't need additional poles or anything from the services side?
The area we're in has very few services in terms of piping, so pipe services, so things like water and gas and stuff just aren't in this area. So everyone has their own treatment plant or septic tank, whichever they may have around here. And then the only two things you do get is electricity and a telephone connection. So to be fair, ESB was, like, I was quite worried about that, I suppose, in terms of I thought that there'd be, you know, ridiculous lead times and that it could just be this crazy price and, you know, God knows what. But to be honest with you, my engagement with them was brilliant. I had such a good experience of dealing with them. It was completely contrary to anything I'd heard from other people. They were very organized and it was very easy to deal with. And yeah, a pole had to be moved, but that was done in a day. They let me know well in advance when it was happening, and it was just done. Like, the expense wasn't crazy. And to be fair, it was all very detailed. I think there's a thing on their website that lets you see, you know, okay, a pole costs X, you know, whatever. There's allowable numbers. So it was all very transparent and, yeah, it felt very comfortable, which was different to my experience with broadband, but that's a whole other kettle of fish.
Oh, God. I don't even want to ask about broadband. How about the well? So you had to drill a well if there was no water.
Well, I suppose in terms of the overall expenses on the build, I went down through the items and we kind of said, okay, well, look, as a starting point, ask everybody for 10% off. Just everybody, no matter who they are, ask them for 10% off. That's just what we did across the board. And by and large, it worked. By and large, to be fair, people were very accommodating. When it came to the well, I just went to my father-in-law and went, you have a well and I need water. Can I just use your well? So he went, okay. So yeah, we're using their well is the simple answer. But we do have provisions made for that. If we ever need to separate wells, we can do that very easily too. So, you know, we've kind of future-proofed as much as we can within reason, certain things like that, you know, where we can, yeah, you can put up. We actually don't have a boundary fence, for example, between us and my in-laws, because we, you know, we didn't need it. It was nice for my girls here to run over unencumbered to their grandparents. So we just didn't bother putting up fencing. So yeah, there's things like that that we can do at a later date.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
And in terms of splurges, still on cost, did you splurge on anything or was it like engineer's precision?
Well, no, I think
value engineering.
Well, Louise will always kind of wonder why we have the PV panels. And I'm saying, well, we need it to be passive. And she's saying, why do we need to be passive? And I'm saying, because we need to be. So the, in terms of the splurging on my side, it's probably that kind of stuff, you know, it was thing. But yeah, there was definitely one or two pieces. Like, I suppose for downstairs, you know, you go for like the engineered timber. For upstairs, we went for the laminate. That kind of thing, where you know you do spend the money in places where you will interact with it the most. You know, so in the kitchen, Munster Joinery, to be fair, were great. They accommodated us with, I think, maybe the largest sliding door they've ever done, or something like that. But it's a very large sliding door because, again, we were trying to do that whole, you know, maximizing glazing bit to the south, and it's a three panel sliding door. So yeah, the things like that, the finishes, yeah, we probably splurged a bit, I suppose, on things like a nice timber dining table, which was kind of,
but that's a good sign. It means you still had money at the end.
Well, we had budgeted for it.
Yeah.
So I had a spreadsheet for everything. So I had a spreadsheet for the budget. And in it, we included items like essential furnishings and non-essential but desired furnishings. So basically, it was built in a way that if it came to it, we could segment out some things. But to be honest with you, a big part of what we did is we did carefully watch the budget. Not in terms of not wanting to spend the money, but in terms of spending it wisely. So even down to something like the cladding, okay? So we have cedral cladding on the side of the building in one section. And it looks like timber cladding, and that's what we wanted to do, is we wanted to look like timber cladding, but I suppose I was a bit dubious about timber as a cladding. Just from a maintenance perspective, I wanted to try and design out maintenance as much as I could. So we went for cedral cladding, and the architect, Tom, really wanted to move us towards kind of a bold colour. So we came up with black, which is very similar to, you know, that burnt larch effect anyway. So we're like, okay, let's do black. But when we went to the local cedral suppliers, we needed a quantity that was about, I think, two-thirds of a pallet of cladding. And they could only, because black wasn't a very popular colour, they could only sell us the black in a full pallet quantity, which would have meant that I'd have had like a couple of hundred quid of extra pallet lats that I, or extra cladding lats that I didn't need and I would never need and I could never sell, because who's going to buy a third of a pallet of black cladding lats? So on that one, I got on to the Cedral website. I found their distributors list. I rang all the distributors in Ireland, and they couldn't do anything for me because they all had the same problem. To be fair, they all had to buy in pallet quantities the rare things, and they bought in individual quantities the popular things, and black wasn't popular, right? But then I got onto the UK, and the UK said, yeah, we can sell you that, no problem. Right now, this was pre-Brexit, so maybe a little bit easier to do that. So I got into a guy in Liverpool who said, yeah, I'll sell you a two-thirds of a pallet of black cladding, no problem. That's grand. But actually, as it happened, they had a sister store in Wicklow. So it was great. So I got onto a man in Wicklow who wasn't actually listed on the original listing, which was really strange. But anyway, that was just the way it was. So I got into your man in Wicklow and I said, listen, I was just talking to Mick over in Liverpool. I need a third of a pallet of this stuff. He went, yeah, no problem. So I got a third of a pallet. I saved myself a couple of hundred quid. You know?
After 20 phone calls and having, yeah, but that's what it takes, isn't it?
It is. And that's definitely the lesson I learned from that was, you know, being clever in sourcing some of the things you're sourcing, not reducing quality. Like I didn't get, you know, reduced quality cladding. I got the stuff I wanted to get, but I got it in a clever way, you know. And it was the same with the flooring, actually. So we went for the engineered timber floor, and I got a price from a local supplier. And then I went on to the floor manufacturer's website. I got, again, a list of their local distributors, local being Ireland, because, like, you buy from anybody in Ireland, you get them onto a Fastway courier or whomever, you know, you choose your preferred local courier, and within the next day or 2 days, you will have it. So it doesn't matter anymore if you buy from Cork or Kerry or Donegal or wherever. You'll get it when you need it, if you've planned it out, you know, timed it well enough. So did the same gig, got on to local distributors, or actually any distributor in Ireland, of that flooring. I knew exactly what I wanted. I knew exactly the quantity I wanted. And I got quotes from all. And then whoever came in with the lowest quote delivered won, because they were all supplying the same thing. It wasn't as if one guy was supplying, you know, one handmade version and the other person was supplying a different handmade version. This was coming from a factory in Belgium. So they were all supplying the same thing. And yeah. I got into one guy in Tralee, I think he is. He was great. He just sorted it out straight away and it arrived in. And again, I saved, you know, odd 10% or whatever on the build. So like 10% doesn't sound like a lot. And sometimes, you know, when you're looking at a bill, you know, okay, it might only come up to, you know, 100 quid of a saving or whatever. But you do that enough of times on a self-build and, you know, you'll find that you'll come in, as we did, kind of within, I think, 1% of budget.
Yeah.
Do you know?
So then the building contract included everything apart from the kitchen, the bathrooms, I presume, the flooring,
so
the decorating.
No, it like, I guess our previous experience of living up in Granagh in our previous house was that, you know, we'd done the painting thing. We'd done the whole, you know, country sheet.
So that was in the contract then, yeah.
Yeah, we learned, yeah. Do you know what? If you're going to paint a house, get someone else to do it. Because
and the heating and plumbing and
heating,
ventilation.
Plumbing, and everything in the contract. Until
okay,
it wasn't.
Apart from the kitchen and the flooring then, is it?
Well, you had this is where things get a bit entertaining.
Legwork.
So when we were going through the contract, and like I said, I went through the contract properly, right? It wasn't as if I'd had a cursory look at it. But maybe this is just where, because I'd never been a client before, I'd always been an engineer, I'd always been whatever, but I was never a client. My understanding of it was maybe a bit different. So a lot of items had gone into PC sums. So things like, you know, stairs and kitchen and, you know, your utility fit out and all that kind of stuff. We're all in the PC sums.
Yeah, which are just estimates. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they always are a pass through cost, to be fair, because the builder has to do that way. There's no other way they can do it. So that's all cool. But the one thing that was in the contract that I didn't realize at the time was there was a builder's discount applied. Okay. Now, contrary to the name, what it actually is it's a handling charge. So to be fair to the builders, you know, they're the ones in the middle of that PC item taking care of, okay, well, have you paid them for the stairs or whatever? So they apply a 1% or 2% or whatever charge to do that. So I didn't realize that happened. I didn't know it wasn't actually in the contract, you know, and I don't think you'd expect anyone to do anything for free, you know? So that makes perfect sense. For most parts. I suppose there was two things. First of all, it wasn't in the contract, so it was a hidden cost. And I was like, oh, hang on, lads, we didn't talk about that. Do you know? So that was one area I was like, this is a learning for me. And the other one was that was true for everything, even if it was a supply and fit by someone else. So the builder literally never touched it. Do you know? So the kitchen, right? Kitchen supply and fit. The builder literally had nothing to do with it. And again,
apart
you know,
from pay them though.
Well, that's where it got interesting, you see. So if you look at how tax is dealt with in Ireland, right, it's 21% for an item. I think it was at the time anyway. These numbers might have changed since. If I just bought a kitchen and didn't get them to install it, I was paying 21% VAT. If I bought a kitchen but the kitchen supplier also installed it, I paid 13 or 13.5% VAT. So the biggest lesson was that if we did the purchase through the PC Sums, it reverted back to 13% because it was a de facto that builders were installing it, right? So very quickly, I went down through the list of PC Sum items and I said, okay, well, anything that's not installed by the builder, it gets taken out because they don't need to be doing anything with this. You know, so for the kitchen, for example, I took it out. I said, no, that's no longer in the PC Sum items. It's gone, right? We'll hold that ourselves. Which we would have done anyway. You know, it didn't make any difference to how things happened. It was purely from a contract perspective, it was dealt with differently.
Yeah.
So we paid 13.5% on that. And then on other items, which were straight purchase, we would have paid 21%, but by going to the builder, we paid 18%, right? Mm-hmm. Again, really small numbers here. You're talking percentages, right? But you add up those percentages, and in the end, it makes a bit of a difference, you know?
Mm-hmm. So 18 because the on top of the 13.5% was their commission, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Which, again, is only fair, mm-hmm. you know? Like, you would course, expect yeah. that. So I suppose it was just little things like that that were kind of maybe a bit unexpected, or like, oh, okay, you know, how do we handle this? How do we deal with it? And you know, you just deal with it professionally, quite frankly. You know, you just go, okay, this has happened. What do we do about it?
Excellent stuff. Well, listen, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Astrid.
That's it for this Self-Build Plus podcast episode. Tune in next time for more tips and advice from experts and self-builders alike. And make sure to explore everything Self-Build Plus has to offer. The Self-Build Plus journey guides you through the process of building and home improving. The Self-Build Plus forum allows you to share and learn from other self-builders. While the Self-Build Plus videos and our Self-Build Plus virtual events are packed with information and advice. With Self-Build, stop dreaming, start building.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.